I'll tell you something I love about being in France, in addition to some seriously delicious butter, and that is the wide selection of wines I can find in France for low prices. It can be much more difficult to source those same bottles back in the States, and that's why I love to buy wines out of France with Ideal Wine. I have bottles shipped to me, hassle-free. It's easy. Ideal Wine has a new auction every week and is a great source for iconic names like Ouette, Louis Roeder, and Domaine Lefleuve, as well as rising stars like Arnaud Lachaud, Gonon, and Tissot. Find the wines you'd rather be drinking at idealwine.com. That's IDEALWINE.com and have the wine shipped to you in the States. Use the promo code FIRST, FIRST, for $15 off your first order of $150 or more. Hey, that's $15 you could save, and that is some good butter money. See for yourself at Ideal Wine.
I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. Before the pandemic, I met with Chef Robert Vifian at Tandin, his restaurant located near the Eiffel Tower and the Rodin Museum in Paris. Tandin, a Vietnamese restaurant in the cultural center of France, has operated for over 50 years and was originally opened by Robert's mother in 1968. Robert joined her in the kitchen in the early 1970s when he was still a young man in his 20s. And then took over the restaurant full-time as chef owner in 1978. Before then, he made a movie, played bass guitar, and survived the Tet Offensive while living in Saigon. Robert was born in Vietnam in 1948 and lived there as a child. When we recorded this interview, he was approaching the age of 70 and planning his first ever return visit to the country of his childhood. Beginning around the 1980s, Tandin became a restaurant frequented by actors and artists, people like Marguerite Duras, Bertrand Tavernier, may he rest in peace, and quite a few Americans in Paris like Owen Wilson and Andy McDowell. It's a small restaurant, the kind where the owner both cooks your meal and opens your bottles of wine. And I do say bottles and not bottle, because Tandin is a place of pilgrimage for many wine aficionados, and no one would go there to try just one wine. The restaurant wine cellar, which I was lucky enough to visit with Robert's brother, Freddie, is absolutely and completely packed with bottles in every possible place and direction. And it is, in fact, the only cellar I have ever been in where you actually have to walk on top of cases of wine to get inside. In the cellar are vintage after vintage of Coche de Riz, Ligneux, Roumier, and many Bordeaux chateaux, as well as, surprisingly, because this is France, some classic California wines. We discussed all of these and more in the interview. Chef Robert and I recorded in the dining room of Tandin in the morning before a service, and occasionally you can discern the noises of a restaurant opening its doors to the public in the background of our conversation, which you will hear soon. But before we get there, I want to play for you a remembrance from Stephen Spurrier, who recently passed away. Robert and Stephen were friends, and Robert taught wine classes for a while at a school that Stephen co-founded. Here is Stephen talking about the origins of that wine school.
The Place La Concorde was full of the American law firms and people like that, and they used to just come by in the evening, not every evening, but they used to make Thursday evenings. So they'd say, okay, Stephen, what's new? And then that was the beginning of the idea of l'Académie du Vin, because I was giving them the wine tastings and, of course, talking them through the wines. And one of them said, you know, if you could ever put this on as in a structured way, we'd love to do a wine course. You know, we don't know anything about wine. And so that got into my mind. And then prior to that, I'd met with John Winroth, who was the wine correspondent on the Herald Tribune, and I kept on sending him bottles that I liked of the note saying, this is Stephen Spurrier, I hope you like this wine. I knew that this should interest him. He'd not replied to any of the wines I sent him. And so instead of just sending it, I went to the Herald Tribune offices in the Rue de Berry in the 8th, and I got in a tiny lift. I asked the desk where John Winroff worked. He said he's on the third floor. So I got out of the lift on the third floor, and there was a tall, thin gentleman going into the lift, and I said, "Sorry to bother you, but where can I find John Winroth?" He said, "I'm John Winroth." And I said, "Well, I'm Stephen Spurrier." "Oh, you're the guy who's sending me all these damn bottles." And I said, "I've got another one for you." He said, "Well, put it on my desk, and I'm going out to lunch. Let's go out to lunch." And so we went to a brasserie, and John and I stayed there two hours or so, drinking Beaujolais, and got on like a house on fire. And he was teaching junior year students, American junior year students, about wine in the back of cafes. And I said, "Look, John, if I can find a premises, I think we could open a wine school together, because you've got this junior year abroad program. You speak fluent French, therefore we can do courses in French. I've got this American, English, Anglo-Saxon clientele. We have the clientele, and since we're starting from nothing, we can create what we're going to teach." He said, "Brilliant idea." And then another bit of luck, the premises next door to the Cave Madeleine came up for sale. It was a locksmith, and they had a big ground floor premises and a big office upstairs. And I was already expanding. This was October 72. And the locksmith shop went out for auction. No one was really bidding. We bought it. And so I took over the locksmith shop, had it entirely renovated and cleaned out, and opened l'Académie du Vin, the first private wine school in France, opened by an Englishman and an American.
John Bronier, who had been born in Greece, was in the habit of using his middle name, Winroth, for the publication of the many wine articles he wrote while living in France. In 1972, he co-founded the wine school with Stephen Spurrier and Patricia Gallagher. But the next year, in 1973, Winroth became severely ill and was diagnosed with a serious kidney condition. When I spoke with her, exporter Becky Wasserman recalled that period of time and her friendship with John Winroth.
The bottles I remember have to do with the circumstance. And John Winroth, who did do this wonderful article in the Herald Tribune years and years ago, was a man who died of a genetic kidney condition. And when he came and told me about it, I mean, I hadn't bought any wines. I went into Bart's cellar and pulled out a Latache, and we sat in the back on the lawn there and we drank it together. I will never forget that bottle, because I remember John told me, which meant, you know, I am going to die one of these days, and so on and so forth. I remember that.
By maintaining careful treatment for his disease, Winroth would go on to live for multiple decades after his initial diagnosis. He continued to write about wine until his retirement in the year 2000, including in a book entitled Wine as You Like It that was published in 1981. John Winroth passed away in 2006. I talk to winemakers all the time, and something they tell me is that oxygen management is a key to aging wine. Finding the right balance is crucial. And that's why I recommend DM's revolutionary cork closures. With DM corks, winemakers can achieve precisely controlled oxygen management after a bottle leaves the winery, ensuring a wine that matures gracefully and reaches its full potential. With over 2 billion DM corks sold each year, it's clear that winemakers worldwide trust DM for consistent results. And DM has recently expanded the permeability options for their popular DM10 and DM30 closures, providing winemakers with even more flexibility to choose a cork that will guarantee the kind of wine life they envision. Banish surprise dud bottles and embrace DM closures. Your customers will thank you. In North America, DM products are exclusively distributed by G3 Enterprises. Ready to ensure the lifespan of your wines? Go to dm-closures.com/IDTT to learn more. That's DIAM-closures.com/IDTT for more information. You were born in 1948.
Yes.
And you were born in Saigon.
I was born in Saigon. I came very early in France when I was 18 months. I left when I was 5, and I went back when I was 20 minus one day.
What was Saigon like as a kid?
Fantastic. Even when we were attacked, you know, during the Tet Offensive in 68. But the funny thing is that you don't realize things are actually dangerous before it came to your door. You live with it, you adjust to what is around, and I made a lot of American friends, playing music with them and so on, being a bass guitarist. Playing, you know, rather simple music like, you know, the Beatles, the Kinks, and I was not such a big fan of Elvis Presley because I think Presley is just a singer. Well, of course, he's a big social influence and so on, but he's not a songwriter.
Yeah, Dylan's a songwriter.
Exactly. Roy Orbison is a fantastic songwriter. Johnny Cash is a songwriter. He didn't write that much, but he was a good songwriter.
Johnny Cash can be affecting with few words. This is really his gift, I think.
Yes.
What were the members of your family like at that time? Did you have a large family?
No. By Vietnamese standard, you know, just my brother and I. My father left Vietnam in 57, my mother in 61, my elder brother in 55, and then myself in 68.
There must have been a wave of Vietnamese immigration around the same time or a little later.
Well, the big wave came after 75, you know, but our case was totally different because we've been French for 3 generations. So I had to come to France in order to go on with my studies because it was very difficult for us to get into Vietnamese universities.
I see. And what did you study in France?
English civilization. I'm a big fan of English music, English literature, and I even wrote 250 pages on gastronomy in the British Isles. That was my MA. And I tried to do my PhD on, you know, the gastronomy in France. And finally, the professor didn't like, you know, the subject. He wanted me to help him on his own works. And I said, okay, I'm dropping out.
So you started to see the culinary arts as part of the culture.
It's enormously important because I do not think that anything enter your body except beverage and food.
How do you think you came to that conclusion?
I just enjoy eating and drinking. So this is why I decided to be a chef. And I got interested in wines, you know, in 68 because of the restaurant. And my father was very angry because there's no point for him in studying if you want to be a chef. So he said to me, pass all your exams. And after that, you do what you want. So I passed my exam. And each time I was passing my exam, he was giving me a reward. And I say, if I'm getting grades, do I get more? He said, yes. So I work hard in order to get more money. And money was for buying record and wine.
Was cooking something that allowed you to spend more time with your mother?
Probably, because she taught me. So I was, constantly with her. And I was much closer to my mother when I was young than my father. It evolved after her death.
And I feel like you've made explicit at times the connections, even in Vietnam, between what we think of as Vietnamese classic dishes and French cuisine. There was a back and forth that you realized.
Yes, the back and forth that I was not conscious of. The aim was to make what I thought was actual, genuine Vietnamese cooking. And because my mother always said to me when we were eating out, this recipe is not correct. So I said to her, you know, in Vietnam, we have almost no culinary books. How can you know it is right or not? I said, you know, we've been doing it. My mother's doing it this way, and it has to be this way. I said to her, maybe it doesn't work like that. So I asked many friends the same recipe, and I try to get many generations, as many generations as possible. So for me, it was a kind of archaeologic research for the recipes. And after that, I said, I was trimming things that I thought was added by families. So you get the central core, which for me was the actual cooking, the actual recipe.
Did you in the back of your mind think that you may not be able to return to Vietnam and you wanted to preserve some of that?
No, because in fact, when I arrived in Paris, my aim was to go back to Vietnam. And it didn't happen because I met my wife and things became a little bit more, I would say, fascinating in France because, of course, of wine and food and so many things. I have not been back yet.
Since you left, how old are you today?
I'll be 17 September.
Were you embraced by the Paris chefs? Did they find camaraderie with you?
Yes, a lot. And strangely, with no Chinese or Vietnamese chef. I'm very close to a lot of French chef, probably because of wine. I'm very close to the Trois Gros, people like that, yes.
What were wine tastings like in the 70s in Paris?
Almost nothing, because the trade was not aware of the fact that they needed to sell wine, and so there was no tasting organized. So what I was doing is that I was buying the wine myself, so I needed money, so this is why I was trying to get grades.
Did your dad, Leon, like wine?
He's interested in wines, but he says it's too complicated, and he was weird because he was drinking wine with ice cubes. He put ice cubes in it. It hurt me, but you know, he's my father, so I say, no, it's not right, but I do whatever you want.
He probably picked that habit up in Vietnam because the climate's warmer.
Yes, the climate is warm, yes, but you have to realize at that time, wine was not that often drank in Vietnam, but it was expensive. But he used to drink a lot of hard liquor, whiskey, so whiskey they drank with a lot of ice cubes. So I think he preferred at that time hard liquor to dilute it somewhat.
But your younger brother really liked wine.
No, Freddie is the elder brother. I'm the younger one. He liked wines, so this is how I convinced him to give his pocket money to me to buy wine together.
And you used to do tastings together?
Yes, and since wine was not expensive, but it was expensive for students, because, you know, students, you need, you know, money to go to discotheques, you know, in the weekend to pick up girls and so on. So we bought a whole bottle. I split it in half. I cork it right away with the actual cork. And we were drinking, you know, the other half. So it allowed us to taste the same wine twice. So I was writing on the etiquette the wine and the date. I still have some that I forgot. So, and some wines are really weird now.
Really? What were some of them?
We could buy, you know, very expensive wines at that time. A bottle of Premier Cru Sauternes was 59, great vintage. Retail at Nicolas, 10 francs. So,
oh, wow.
It means a euro and a half. Petrus, very rare. You can find that, you know, occasionally, but in other shops, it was something like 35 francs. Ikem was 35. The Premier Grand Cru was around 30, 35. So my pocket money was weekly 50. With my brother, we had 100. So, of course, we were not drinking Premier Cru. Just, you know, for Christmas or things like that. Because Nicolas, during Christmas time, was opening the rare wines cellar. So I bought my first Romanée Conti thanks to Nicolas. But they was only selling one bottle per person. So we cheated. We went to different shops in order to buy, well, two or three more. I remember buying something like 25 francs, Musigny 49, Vouguet. So we picked up, you know, 20 bottles of it in different shops, some of them in the suburbs. So you had to take, you know, the trouble to do it.
When did you meet Steven Spurrier?
I met Steven Spurrier. He came to dinner, and we became friends because it's easy at that time, but not so many people interested in, you know, seriously passionate about wine. I think it was around 73. And after that, he told me he was going to do a wine tasting course in English in Paris, I think you're out of your mind. It's a stupid idea. And he was doing it with John Winroth, which was writing for Wine in the Herald Tribune. Unfortunately, John Winroth had a very bad kidney disease. He had to have dialysis, you know, twice a week. So he left the Academy. And the Academy was very successful. I was really surprised. And so Stephen asked me, I need a teacher, so can you do it for me? So I was teaching for a year and a half. I was studying English in order to be a teacher. Funny thing, I never taught anything but food and wine.
What was your approach to teaching?
You show them, you know, the most typical wine of that area. You tell them vaguely how it's made and about the terroir. And you taste the wine and you discuss it. But most of the time, you did all the talking. Because people are not that inquisitive. I'm surprised. But maybe because the lesson was something like an hour and a half, and people would rather learn than ask questions, because question takes time.
Sometimes I think people are afraid to be embarrassed, you know, by asking the wrong question.
Yes, and sometimes, you know, when they're beginners, you know, they rather listen.
What was your approach to tasting? What kind of taster were you?
I've always been extremely meticulous. I always took notes, much less now because I have less time, and the tasting now are so huge. Sometimes, how can you take notes when serious notes when you have 300 wine to taste, you know, in 3 hours? So now I rely on my memory. I just put a few. In fact, I like taking notes when I have the time because it allows me to breathe. And I think breathing is very important because otherwise you breathe alcohol all the time. You need to breathe, you know, some air, some oxygen, you know, to detox your lung for a few seconds.
Did you always have a good memory? It seems to me you have a good memory.
Well, a little bit less now because I'm getting old. But
I don't think so. You're pretty sharp.
Well, let's see.
But was it an advantage you had in school? Could you just remember things well?
Yes. But, you know, I've been, you know, the serious type of students, always underlining, taking notes. And but wine is more fun because it's really actual. You taste, so you have the pleasure. It's not just words or figures.
What was Spurrier like back then?
Spurrier, he was very close to me, tasting-wise. He's serious, and he was very like me. He was a close friend. I asked him to be best man at my wedding. And what was accepted, unfortunately, he slipped a disc. So I replaced him by Alain Du Tournier.
It's always good to have someone who can walk be your best man, right?
Yes. But we're very close. You know, we were going to Burgundy together because Stephen was less keen on Burgundy than I was. And he said to me, that was very nice. I need your support. So come. So I was coming with him. So, but it was really interesting because he knew many more people than I did because he opened a wine shop. And I only was, you know, at that time, the restaurant was not buying enormous quantities of wine. But anyway, a wine retailer and a wine restaurateur, there was two persons that people wanted to meet because for them it's selling. He introduced me to Lafon, in fact. I came down to Lafon with Serge Fichon, who was representing Lafon at that time. And we met the father.
René.
René, yes. And after that, I met Dominique. And Dominique was working at a certain time, maybe for more than a year, for Becky Wasserman when I met him. And when he took over the domain, it was with his brother, Bruno. And Bruno was working at the same time for Drouin. And after that, you know, funnily enough, I think there was not enough money for them to make from the property for two persons. So Bruno left and did something else. I think he got involved in jewelry or...
What was the difference between René's wines and Dominique's wines that you started to see?
Dominique wines, especially, I think I told them when I first tasted it, I thought that the challenge was to make the Mourache better than the rest, seriously better than the rest. He succeeded, and he made much better reds than the father.
His reds are really good for a white winemaker, you know what I mean? Because it's not often
yes.
that people are good at both.
But he makes, always make powerful wines. He's not capable of making a Meunier's wine.
What was René like back then?
Funny.
Yeah.
Because he was an engineer and was teaching at Art et Métier in Paris. And he was interested in winemaking and not at all by the culture. So this is why most, I think all of the, well, not all, but most of the vineyards was farmed by people like Pierre Moret and sometimes I bought a Morachet from Pierre Moret and a Morachet from Lafont. I was comparing them since it was very precise, since, you know, they're pressing the juice and they take 50% each. So it's the actual same juice. And the wines are incredibly different. Were incredibly different because I do not have any left from Pierre Moret. Pierre Moret had, I think he also had part of the Claude Labarre.
I didn't know that. That makes sense, though, as Métillage.
Yes, yeah. Because of Métillage and Dominique, after that, had to take back all the Métillage. And it was difficult. But he said with Pierre, it was totally fine. Pierre was a gentleman. Because, of course, you know, for most of the farmers, it's a loss of money. And Dominique make a fantastic quality leap for the viticulture because he's by name mission and so on. It's fantastic.
And you did harvest at Jacques Brier?
Yes, because they always invite us, you know, to harvest, you know, the Moachet. It never happened. We always harvesting something else, sometimes, you know, under the rain. But we always had, you know, a fantastic lunch at the top of the Moachet. It's been great fun.
Who else were you close to in Burgundy?
Well, more or less Roumier. Koch, but Koch is a very special person. Jean-François, he's a nice person, but he's not congenial. So I remember the first time we went down tasting, he was taking the pipette, pouring some wine to us, and after that he went topping the other barrels, as if, you know, he didn't care at all of our comments. Didn't trust him. I had that impression. But he was very nice to me since, you know, sometimes I was, you know, he was driving me, you know, to other vintages and so on.
The first vintage of Koch you had was 1981.
The first vintage I bought was 1981, but not from him. I bought from London because you couldn't find the wine in the shops. And so I met Simon Taylor-Gill. I don't know if you know about him, but he was teaching in France, and he guy is a great taster, and he knew a lot about wines, and he was exporting to England Rouleau, Lafont, I think, and Koch. So I bought Koch from him, and it was very funny because I didn't know Koch at that time, and I remember there was outside his house a barrel with a bottle and with a sign saying, "We sell wine."
I don't think that barrel's there anymore.
Yeah, no, not anymore.
What were the wines like at that time?
Very close to what they are now.
Is that true? In the 80s, they were similar?
Yes. And he had his special style of winemaking, so it's fun.
What did you attribute that to?
I think it's the combination of a lot of lees and sulfur, plus, you know, the very good oak.
What does a Koch that's young smell like to you?
For me, it's a funny smell, but it stinks a little bit. It's interesting, bad odor, and it's easy to recognize in a blind tasting. So I remember when I was making blind tasting, I always put a Meursault or a Pouligny against Meursault. I put a Koch, so I say, you know, here's Koch. See, the other one should be like this, and like this. But I always compared, you know, the stinkiness of the Koch wine to the mole on Marilyn Cheek.
A beauty mark.
Yes, a beauty mark.
A friend of mine thinks Koch of that era smells like curry leaf.
For me, it's more like durian. Well, it's not exactly durian, but that kind of nice, nasty, but good.
And I think you visited almost every year, Koch, since that time?
Yes. Not every year. It depends because I do not like bothering them, you know. But sometime I went down with Steve Tanzer because I enjoy tasting a lot with Steve. He's very good for Burgundies and he's a very good taster.
He's also a very deliberate taster, and I think that you may be as well.
Yes, but he's not a marathon tasting like you know, Bob or myself. He likes tasting few wines. I want to taste as much as possible.
And you became fairly knowledgeable about the different crews of Coach.
Yes.
So if you were to run through that with me so that I could learn more, because it's a weak point for me, what would you tell me?
The Perrier and the Rougeau are the most interesting wines for me, especially the Rougeau, price-wise, is incredibly. It's probably the wine I would advise people to buy before the Perrier, because the Perrier is really... And Charlemagne, for me, is probably because of the price in secondary markets. I think, you know, it's disproportionate when you compare it to the Perrier. But now I've noticed that the Perrier is getting more and more expensive and getting closer to Charlemagne. In the old days, it was double.
Is his Perrier parcel next to Rouleau's parcel?
Well, these are very good parcels, yes. Well, the parcels are probably better than the parcel from Lafon. And strangely, with Lafon, I'm always enamored with the Charme, because he has such a big surface compared to, you know, proportionally to Burgundy, that he can pick the best ones. And right. He can discard a few of them.
And with Coach, he used to use a basket press, right?
Oh, yes. And I'm wondering if he hasn't bought one from Louis Picamelo, you know, the best bubblies from Burgundy.
And he used the bottle with a fountain direct from the barrel?
I'm not sure, because I think the wines are quite homogeneous. So it means that he cannot do it like Jaillet was doing in a barrel by barrel. So he's not filtering. I have noticed that on the new labels, he was mentioning no filtration. In the old labels, it was Sauvin n'a pas été filtré.
Did you ever talk to him about filtering or fining?
Like most people, I think, you know, Burgundy lover, we thought that not filtering was good. I'm not that sure now, because I did something worse in 93 with Maurice Écart for the Serpentière. And my barrel was unfined and unfiltered, so no collage. And when it started, it was better than the one that has not been fined, and was much better than the wine has been fined and filtered. I do not have any bottle left of the regular bottling from Louis Écart, Maurice Écart, Louis or Maurice, I can't remember, probably Maurice. But I have the impression now that my wine that has not been collé is slightly less precise. And maybe the bacteria are doing something that is less fine. But you can like it. It's getting slightly more animal and less, you know, floral fruity.
And so when you would visit Coach, what was he like as a person besides not listening to you? What was he like?
Well, now it has changed a lot, but that was the first time we went. And he looks so much like a priest, and he's very serious, but he's a very nice person.
What do you think he was aiming to achieve? Did he ever share that with you?
I think he was aiming to achieve the best white wine possible, because I think that he told me one that his father was not interested in white wine, and that was his challenge. And Koch made irregular red wines. The son is now making great red wines.
When was your first visit to Christophe?
In the 70s, but at that time it was Jean-Marie, his father. I met Jean-Marie, who was very nice, and at that time it was very easy to taste the wines. And you can taste the wine, I say, you know, okay. I'm not very rich. I can only buy one or two bottles of Musigny. And of course, I could buy, you know, the rest. But it was simple. And now to get a bottle of Musigny, it's impossible.
How do you think it's the same or different how he interprets the Chambord crews versus the Maurice Saint-Denis crew?
Well, it's very faithful to the terroir. Since I think the Maurice Saint-Denis tastes like Maurice Saint-Denis. It's the tannins are less, I would say, less refined. And the Chambord village is stunning for a Chambord village. And are the Ruchot that much different from a Bonnemare sometimes? Yes, but I'm not 100% sure I'll pick them out in the blind tasting.
Did you try the Bonmar red soil, white soil comparison?
Yes, often. So it depends on the vintage. I prefer, you know, the red or the white, yes. I think, you know, the assemblage is better.
Better together.
Because some years, you know, the tannins are harsher, and some with the red, sometimes less. It's not as easy. It is different, but not that dramatically different. So I think it's a good idea, this assemblage.
And what do you think Christoph's strengths are as a domain owner?
He does everything right, but I always have impressions he can do better. That's strange. I taste, you know, almost every year, you know, at the domain. And I come out, I think, no, it's great. And in the early stage, the ones are great. If you have the opportunity to come to taste, you know, at the kind of association with a domaine familial, as they call it. And it's normally in March at Le Doyen. And they give always bottled wine. And you can taste them side by side. You have Meo, Griveaux, you have Ravenau, you have Drouin, you have... So you can taste Rousseau, you can taste them side by side. And most of the time, I think at Roumier, Bonnemare is the best wine of the whole tasting. And when I taste the old wine, sometimes I say, not as good as I hoped. And same for, you know, the parcels that are owned by really one of my best friends, Michel Bonfond, who owns the Ruchot. I love the Ruchot. It's not aging as well as I want, which is a shame. But I tasted a few 78 recently, and they are stunning. So it's always maybe a fantasy of mine that I wanted to be better.
What were some of the key Burgundy domains that you really became familiar with that don't exist anymore? What were real standouts from old bottles that have disappeared?
The obvious one is Henri Jaillet. And I think Henri Jaillet was a master, because it was such a harmony between the viticulture, the winemaking, the élevage, the bottling, and even the marketing. Because each time you meet him, you say, what a lovely person. Very simple, clear. I know he can explain things that are in an extremely clever and intelligent way. Very easy to understand what he says. He doesn't try to fool people. He was a great guy. And the thing that is it better than the Conti? Is it the DRC winemaking better than the, or Le Roy better winemaking? Because they insist more on leaving the stems. And not Jaillet. Jaillet was totally, I think he never made wine with stems. And I have tendency to be more into the destemming.
You like that?
Yes, because being a tea drinker, I know about extractions. And I can see, you know, the harshness of certain things. So that's a problem. And when I see, you know, that the cheap teas have... Well, not stem, but they have, you know, the end of it, which is harder, and very few leaves, you can see the difference. So this is why, you know, I do not like certain grape varieties that over tannic.
And what did you see as the difference between the crews that Jaillet vinified?
Well, the hierarchy is totally weird at Jaillet, because normally the Richebourg should be the best, the Échéreau should be second, the Cropin to third, and then, you know, the Brûlé, the Merger, and so on. For the three best, which means Cropin to Échéreau and Richebourg, none of them is winning constantly when you put them side by side. And I think it is due to the fact that it was bottling barrel by barrel. So it's complicated. The last, you know, time we did it, and I'm not sure we'll do it again, because you have to find the wines. We did Richebourg, Échéreau, and Cropinto 78. The Échéreau were the best. The Cropinto was the least interesting of the three. Strange.
What do you think Cropinto expresses at its best? What are the characteristics of it?
Which is the characteristic of Jaillet in general? Extremely pure fruit, extremely good oak, sweet wines, civilized tannins, and always kept a florality to it. But it's almost with all is one when you compare it to, you put it side by side with other growers. Which is the most intense? The most intense wine for me is still the Richebourg. And after that, I would say the Croix, and after that, the Échirolles. But maybe Échirolles is more interesting now for us because I think most of the, I would say, bulimic tasters now are going from heavily extracted Burgundy to much lighter.
Did you visit Domaine Lefleuve?
Yes, I used to visit more than I do. And in fact, I love going tasting, you know, at Domaine Lefleuve with Steve Tanzer. Because Steve Tanzer is allowed to taste the Moache, so when I'm with him, I'm allowed to taste the Moache.
That's cool.
I was close to Anne Claude. I remember when we had, you know, tasting at Le Doyen, or for the Domaine Privé, she was around, and often, you know, we went upstairs to eat at the restaurant, and she's a very nice person. She was a very nice person.
What do you remember about her?
She was extremely keen on biodynamics and very early. So, and she was right. I remember she always wanted to prove it to us when she started, you know, doing the Clavoyant. We always taste the Clavoyant with special vines and not special vines. And the difference was startling.
What did you see as that difference?
More depth.
In the biodynamic?
Yes, and slightly more acidity. Or the impression of acidity. Because, you know, you can be fooled by the taste, and when you see, you know, the figures, and you say, oh, that's not different. But, and her father, Vincent, he's an ex from Vietnam, so he came very often, so we talk a lot. And I remember I always had easily allocation, and even if, when I... Sometimes I forgot because maybe I didn't like the vintage, but I didn't say that I didn't like the vintage. I didn't buy the wine. I could get back my allocation.
What do you think some of the keys were to those wines in terms of understanding them?
The Lefleuve wine for me are puzzling because they are less fleshy than the wines from Lafon or Koch. They are more steely. It doesn't prevent them to have free moxes. And they are more heavily sulfured. It doesn't prevent them to be oxidized.
Have you had the 15s?
Yes, I received it. So it's funny because one of my close Belgian friends, we tasted together at the Domaine Familiaux, and he said, this is a wine not to be bought from the Lefleuve 15th. I tasted the wine. I didn't say to him, you're damn wrong, the wine is fantastic. So I wrote a letter saying, you know, I want my allocation, if you could get more, it's better. And this friend, he's a good taster, but he probably was influenced by people.
What are some of your favorite vintages of Domaine Lefleuve?
96. 96, she sold it to me, and she said, you know, don't sell it. Please keep it at least 10 years. I still have very few bottles left, and they are stunning.
I believe that you follow Hubert Ligné pretty closely.
Well, yes, I buy every year from them. Shame that Romain died. He was a very nice person and very talented. Laurent is a more congenial person. You know, let's hope he'll be as talented as... well, we'll see. I buy wine every year, so maybe I should make a vertical tasting.
What have you seen change in the Burgundy market since the 70s? I mean, it must be a striking difference.
It's striking different, and the prices are up, up, up. I understand, you know, these last vintages that they have to raise the price because the harvest was so small. And now, you know, there's too much demand for the end. Well, normally, they should raise much more because the demand is there. But it's dangerous. And you see Koch is not doing it. The prices direct from Gosh are very soft. So I think that's the way to do it. But you cannot satisfy the demand, the world demand. And you can see, you know, the price of Gosh now in the secondary market, they are soared up incredibly. And it's more or less deserved since he didn't have premoxes. And most of the other ones are having premoxes.
Did it surprise you how popular Burgundy ended up getting from the perspective of being there in the 70s and 80s? Has it been surprising?
It's totally amazing. I thought that people would get away from Burgundy. I was hoping so. It didn't happen. And strangely enough, the Asians are keen on Burgundy, which I think is really surprising because the marketing of Bordeaux was so fantastic. And especially the smaller Bordeaux has lost a lot of interest from people. And now they're more interested in Burgundy. And finally now, what the American wine press now is keen on Burgundy, they used not to. Because who was actually buying a lot of Burgundies in the old time? Very few people, except for the DRC, Vaugue, you know, the really, I would say, famous and expensive ones. And now things are changing, probably thanks to DRC and Jaillet and Koch, you know, that the three made magic name for them.
And how did you find that Burgundy interacted with your cuisine?
You know, pairing wine and food is much more complicated than one thinks, you know. I wrote a few articles about it. But it's extremely personal. People do not chew then drink the same way. Some people are chewing very quickly, swallowing and drinking right away. Some people leave a few seconds. And when you leave a few seconds, it's always easier. And you have to take into consideration something that is not very interesting or pretty to hear, but nobody has the same dental cavities. So it means that dental cavities, when they are deeper or larger, you have more residues of the food, of the solid food, and they stay in the cavities. So it means that they are present for a very long time, and the wine just, you swallow the wine, you drink it, and you swallow it very quickly. So the time of the contact between the wine and the food is totally disproportionate. So this is how, for me, people do not feel that the pairing of food and wine is the same for, when you take it, oh, this goes well, and say, you know, for me, it doesn't go well. It's one of the answers for me.
We've spoken a fair amount about Burgundy, but I know that you spend a lot of time in Bordeaux as well.
Yeah. Especially Pommerol, since I was nicknamed Monsieur Pommerol by L'Amateur des Vins de Bordeaux.
And how did you see the different terroirs of Pommerol?
Well, when you speak about chateaux, which are brands, it's more complicated because I remember at a certain time I went down with a map, a very detailed map, you know, of Pommerol, and I wanted, you know, the growers to show me where are their parcels. And sometimes they're really space over, you know, it's not one stuff, it's the parcel all over the appellation. So it means that the wines are not as terroir telling as Burgundy. Well, Burgundy, of course, you know, they can have different plots, you know, all over the appellation, but it's more precise in Burgundy. So the terroir, of course, you know, we all know that it's the grave and the clay are the two most important things in Pommerol. And the strange thing at Pommerol is that, you know, the little bit like Puligny-Montrachet, it's very difficult to have cellars because they have water. When you dig, you get water right away. And have you noticed that at Puligny-Montrachet, there are no cellars? They cannot dig.
For you, what's the difference between the clay expression of Pommerol?
Yes, because clay and Merlot is almost a perfect match, at least so far. The upper part of Pommerol with heavily with special clay are more quality driven, and after that you have the assemblage. You have assemblage of course of grape varieties and of plots, and the grape variety is very interesting because Pommerol is almost 100% Petrus is almost 100% Merlot. And a lot of people are trying to emulate that. Le Pin is 100% Merlot. And some of the Saint-Emilion are becoming 100% Merlot. They're going back to Cabernet Franc now. I remember in the old days, people were always saying to me, Médoc is Cabernet Sauvignon, Pommerol is Merlot, and Cabernet Franc is Saint-Emilion, which is less and less true. Even the Merlot is gaining ground. And Saint-Emilion, Cabernet Franc is making a big comeback.
How have you seen structural differences like that between the 70s and now in Bordeaux?
The technique has evolved a lot. The cultural a lot also, because some of them, few, but are going to biodynamics. And it's becoming more and more precise, because in the old days, there was no second wines. Everything that was harvested was in the premier vin. And now you have first, second wine, and you have four wines sometimes. I think what has Château Latour, Le Grand Vin, Les Forts de Latour, Pauillac, and they probably have a wine that they sell in bulk. So we've got four hierarchies of wine. So I think it is the important point, selections, and now the biodynamics or culture that are much more well done than the other days. The yields are probably lower. The vinification has changed a lot. Much more, I would say, better extraction. And now some of them do not want to call it extraction anymore. They want you to call it infusion. And in my opinion, the best quality-price ratio now is in Bordeaux. And especially the Bordeaux Supérieur and Première Côte, Côte de Blaye, you know, Côte de Fonds, and so on. I think the quality is incredible for the price. And they cannot sell as easily as they want. So it's totally unfair. And if you make blind tastings with a lot of wines with the Cru Classé, the difference now is minimal and the price is much higher. I think people should go back to Bordeaux. They deserve it, and the wines are actually fantastic. They're reliable. I remember 20 years ago I was tasting for Cuisine et Vins de France. That was one of the most fascinating tastings, plural. We did it for a few years. Supermarket wines. So it means that Karine Valentin, who was the head of that tasting, she was buying wines from the supermarket, bottled wines. And you have Côte du Rhône, you have Bordeaux, Burgundy. Bordeaux was very reliable. Le Sud, it was Languedoc-Roussillon, was rather reliable. The worst was Burgundy. The Burgundy that you found in the supermarket was filthy. And it happened much more in Burgundy. I was really surprised. But over 20 years ago.
When we return from the break, an important figure in the history of Bordeaux enters into Robert's life and becomes a key mentor for him.
When did you first meet Jean-Claude Berouet?
In the late 70s.
That's coming up right after this. It's not enough to make great wine. You also have to reach the consumer that appreciates that wine. And that's where Offset is an incredible asset. Offset is an independent brand design and commerce technology company that connects with wineries on a human level to help them connect with consumers on a human level. Offset is based in wine country and staffed by creative strategists and technologists who are superb at helping create and evolve wine brands through visual identity and package design, developing the look, feel, and tone of your web content, as well as building beautiful and effective websites powered by their proprietary e-commerce platform, Offset Commerce. That's why leaders like Frog's Leap, Grace Family Vineyards, and Rain Winery already rely on Offset. Reach out to the brilliant team at Offset at offsetpartners.com. That's OFFSET partners with an S.com. Offset is focused on the wine industry and can embrace the nuanced needs of your wine brand. As the technical director of establishments Jean-Pierre Moyex, Jean-Claude Berouet oversaw the winemaking for famed Bordeaux properties Chateau Petrus, Chateau Trottinois, and several others. But Berouet was not the obvious choice for the job that he would end up holding for over 40 years. When he was originally hired by Jean-Pierre Moyex, Berouet was still a young man, and the chance to make Chateau Petrus initially came to him as a bit of a shock. This is how Jean-Pierre's son, Christian Moyex, recalled that period of time. Christian and Jean-Claude Berouet would end up working together at Petrus and at other properties for about four decades.
Jean-Claude Berouet was met first by my father as a trainee He was 22 in 1964, and he met my father, and at his own surprise, I mean, Jean-Claude was very surprised, my father said, why don't you come and work for us? His approach, almost philosophical, and which fits so well my father's approach, was wine is for drinking, you see. So clearly, he would love the wines, and Merlot was such a fit for him, to be gentle, to be pleasant, to give pleasure.
It was a new era for Petrus when Barraway took over the winemaking in 1964, as the previous owner, Madame Lubat, had passed away in 1961. Christian Moyax joined Barraway at Petrus in 1970, and when you hear about the vintages of Petrus from around that time, it can sound like they were striving for an understated interpretation of a terroir that tended to give powerful wines. Rather than playing for even more power and even more alcohol, they elected to do the opposite.
Petrus was always higher in alcohol than its neighbors. Even in those weak vintages of the 70s, we were always at 13. There's a natural richness. What is so special about Petrus, it is a wine with great character, I would say. Complexité is a word which is abused, but there's, of course, a complexity in any great wine. But character, you know, it stands by itself.
It's worth emphasizing here that Petrus, amongst Pomerol wines, can stand out for how powerful it is. As a wine from Pomerol, Petrus is not typical, and that is something many people have noted as a compliment of that wine.
Among the Pomerols, which, as I said, are so approachable in their youth, that will not apply to Petrus. Petrus has a natural structure. I will not say tannic structure, but a structure which makes it a little, how could I say, hautain in French, I would say. That dignity means that here I am what I am, and that's it, you see. So then it softens with age, but that natural structure, I would say, is a man who is convinced of, not of his quality, but of his strength, you see.
You can grasp here the juxtaposition of Barraway's style, which privileged drinkability instead of extraction, with the terroir of Petrus, which tended to give wines of strength and structure. I have never spoken to Jean-Claude Barraway about this or even asked him this question, but it seems to me from this vantage point that he was playing a bit against type when it came to Petrus, probably because he did not want the wines to become overblown or made into a caricature of themselves. He was producing Petrus in a more understated way without going for a super ripe result. Now, the important thing to understand is that as the 1980s moved into the 1990s, Chateau Petrus was acknowledged and widely praised as one of the very greatest wines in the entire world. Both the 1989 and 1990 vintages of Petrus received 100-point scores from the influential wine critic Robert Parker, scores that indicated that they were perfect wines. But by the time the early 2000s had come along, Jean-Claude Barraway was somewhat taken to task by that same wine critic, and Parker labeled Barraway's approach as ultra-conservative in multiple editions of his books. When applying that label, Parker probably had in mind as a contrast the higher ripeness levels associated with another Right Bank winemaker, Michel Roland. Barraway was often contrasted with Roland around that time. Barraway, for his part, rejected the trend towards what he termed a standard taste, or what might be referred to as Parkerization these days. And here it is worth keeping in mind that wines from the same grape varieties, as they move towards overripeness, tend to taste more and more alike. These discussions about ripeness weren't always entirely amicable at the time, and they were not academic either. Parker's opinions had large ramifications in the wine buying market. Christian Moyax, when I brought up the question of ripeness, said that that subject had always been a tricky one between himself, Parker, and Jean-Claude Barraway. And Barraway, for his part, was quoted in the Washington Post in 2006 as saying, "A wine should tell you the story of the place it came from. If I'm a conductor playing Mozart, can I add notes to it? Pretentious men do this." Which sounds pretty steadfast about his own approach. But it seems clear that the criticism of that approach was also on his mind when he further remarked in that same interview, "You need to be realistic, and the day you can't make a living, you have to change." Jean-Claude Barraway would retire from Establishment's Jean-Pierre Moyex the very next year, in 2007. The man who had originally hired him to make Petrus, Jean-Pierre Moyex, had already passed away back in 2003. Christian Moyex would note in his remarks about Barraway that Barraway had always favored elegance over extraction. But it's worth noting that Christian Moyex, when I interviewed him, discussed his own shift towards preferring a riper style of wine in more recent years.
Since I left Petrus, it's a fascinating experience. It's a second youth for me, or a third career, I don't know, to give to the other chateaus, specifically La Flotte Petrus, Trotanois, the right amount of concentration I like. And probably the recent vintages I have made are a little richer, a little more concentration, a little higher level of tannins as well. That's what I like today. It may be an evolution. When you get older, you need stronger wines. Wines have become kind of an elixir for me and a medication almost.
And a similar shift also happened for the wines of Chateau Petrus, where a riper, more powerful expression of the wine is made today by Olivier Barraway, who is one of Jean-Claude Barraway's sons. Let's return to Robert Vifian's interview to hear more about his first meeting with Jean-Claude Barraway.
When did you first meet Jean-Claude Barraway?
In the late 70s. I had an appointment. I was supposed to meet Jean-Claude, and out of luck, I was having lunch at with my wife at Logis de la Cadenne in Saint-Emilion, and was sitting with a friend of his just next. And so during the meal, he stood up and he asked me, "Are you the person I'm going to meet this afternoon?" I said, "If you are Jean-Claude Barraway, yes." So this is how we connected. And after that, we probably shared a few glasses in the restaurant. So we had a nice chat together. And I learned tremendously from him. Wine tasting and pommel.
What did he tell you?
About acidity and about sweetness and acidity in the wine. And he said to me, "Be careful, because sometimes you think you had this acidity and it's not totally correct." And he showed me, the analysis of the wine. Said, "See, you got this acidity in this wine and the other one." So sometimes it's counterbalanced by a certain kind of richness in the wine or whatever. It helped me a lot
to realize the perception and
yes, there were things that are more complex than the just direct taste of acidity in your mouth. And after that, sometimes I ask, "Do you have the chemical analysis? I want to see them for that wine." Some of them do not want. So, well.
And what was the style of Jean-Claude Barraway?
Jean-Claude Barraway, I think it's close to Pinot in a way, but he was more interested than Pinot with viticulture, and which was extremely rare at that time with Bordeaux people, with, winemakers in general. Especially that they are enologists. They are not supposed to be, not to tend the vines. But he got interested very early.
And how did you see the characteristics of the different Moyex properties?
Well, the style Jean-Claude is, I would say, refined from Émile Pinot, plus, cultural stuff. And the style is still, well, if you want to compare it to Michel Roland, which is somebody I like very much, I would say it's almost between Morte and Meunier.
With Morte being Roland.
Exactly. And more extraction, more sweetness, and rightly so. And I do think that the Berouesson is evolving slightly toward the Roland style. In some lunches, you know, there was lunch with the Pommol Union. I was eating, you know, normally with the Roland or the Moëx, and I was in the shifting. And people were saying this was really strange. I'm friends with both of them. This is no point. We can discuss, you know.
And you developed a rapport with both Michel Roland and Robert Parker.
Yes. Robert Parker was introduced to me by a late friend who was heading something like IDV, you know, Chateau Loudun. And since at that time I was specializing in Pommol, so Bob came over with that person, Martin Bamford. And he wanted me to tell him about the Pommol. So this is how we became friends. And thanks to him, Michel Roland came to see me, and we became very close with Roland. And at that time, it was easy to taste with Parker, because Michel were organizing a tasting in Chateaus. Well, Chateau de Pommol, when we're tasting the Pommol, in the afternoon we're tasting the Saint-Emilion, and after that we're tasting, you know, the Lesser Appellation in another chateau, and we're moving like that. And some of the owners were invited, and starting from 1990, Michel decided no, it was only the owner of the property, himself, and Parker. And still I was around, Parker told me, okay, Robert, come with us. So we're tasting the four of us, just like that. And it went on for a long time.
What did you observe about Parker as a taster?
Parker is an extremely reliable taster. He can be very good at blind tasting also. When it comes to wine that he likes, he's extremely spontaneous. I'm almost the opposite, since I taste according to the appellation. I do not taste according to my taste. Well, I taste according to my taste, but also according to the appellation. Parker is more closer to his taste. So this is how he can be so reliable.
Seemed like a nice guy in person.
Parker's a darling. But he can be really interesting because sometimes when we were tasting at some chateaus and I got out of it, I said, you know, I don't like the wine of the owner. And he said to me, me neither. So I said, you know, how can you? When he's hosting us, we're having lunch with him, you know, tasting old wine and so on. So it would be difficult for me to write, you know, for me, no. And he said to me, no problem, I'll do it anyway. I think that's great stuff because it's so kind and so spontaneous, and sometimes it can be totally impartial. So that's an interesting dichotomy. And this is one of the reasons why I do not want to write about it, because I have friends and it's difficult for me to put them down. And I always try to be not too nasty, so it's not a good way of writing.
What else struck you about Parker?
His appetite. He eats as much as I do. His favorite restaurant is probably Le Milouis. And Le Milouis, his portions are enormous. But I'm eating, well, according also to the appellation. When I have to eat a lot, I can eat a lot. When I eat, you know, Japanese food, or I can eat very little. But he has enormous appetite. And he's a great taster, no doubt about it. I remember a few blind tastings with the picked out the wine easily, because at L'Angelus, I remember, he picked out two or three wines.
And what did you recognize about Michel Roland as a taster? Because he's famed for being a good blender.
He's a fantastic taster. And he's should be better than we are, because he knows about the technical aspect of the wines. He knows about the figures, analysis, and so on. And we do not know that much about vinification, élevage, and so on. And the guy has so much experience, you know. He's vinifying in so many vineyards, so many countries. How many wines do a guy from Bordeaux makes when he's just an owner? Just one or two wines. He makes 100 wines a year. So can you imagine, you know, the experience he has gathered? And he, what is extraordinary about Roland, he's tasting. He's one of the best tasters I know.
Yeah, is that true?
Yeah.
What is noticeable about that?
He tastes very quickly, precisely. I do not see, I've never seen him taking notes, because I think he just wants to know what he does with it. He's very focused. He probably has an idea in mind each time he's tasting a wine.
So Spurrier gave you a sort of early introduction to California wine.
Yes, he was a seminal, because I didn't know anything about American wine except, you know, the jug wine that you can find, you know, in supermarket. So he made a trip there and he introduced me to all these wines that I think some of them are stunning.
And you got to try some of the Paris wines, Paris tasting wines.
Yes. When Stephen staged it, he said to me, you know, I need tasters that are names and you're not well known enough. So he called me, he said to me, okay, I cannot invite you to that tasting. You know the reason, but come with me the morning after. We'll taste the leftover. So we tasted the leftovers, just the two of us.
What was that like?
The results was almost the same. So it was extremely embarrassing for the French wines at that time. And Stephen was blacklisted for a few years in Burgundy because of that tasting.
You ended up buying some California wine for the restaurant.
Stephen and I gave a list of wine we wanted from California. Yeah, one that I tasted with him. And a friend of ours, Pamela Mead, imported the wines. At that time, it was very cheap. So even cheaper, that the dollar was at the lowest point compared to the French franc. And we bought a lot of wines from, and unfortunately, I think very few people bought from her. She went bankrupt. This is how I have, you know, wine from the mid-70s from the States, and some of them are incredibly good.
What have been standouts for you?
Of course, you know, the Heights, the Maya Camus, Sterling. What else is really good? Ridge, of course. Ridge is the closest to Pouillac for me. I had a vertical tasting of Ridge, was spectacular. And it tasted like, well, the young ones are American, but the old ones were French.
I know what you mean by that.
Yeah.
It takes a second for it to make that switch, the way the oak reads, I think.
But they were great. And the Zins are fantastic.
What do they think about Zin in Paris?
I don't know much about Zin in Paris. I love Zin. What about Zin from that incredible lady winemaker, Helen something, no?
Helen Turley, the Martinelli Zins?
Yes. Well, friends brought me the Zin from her. I think they are spectacular. They're big wines, but they are what they should be. You expect wine from the States to be strong, not light and delicate. So, and some of them being, you know, in American oak, it's been better.
And you've made wine a few times.
Not exactly make. You know, I had wine made like I hoped, but I cannot control everything because I'm not, you know, on the spot. Yes, I started making special cuvées for myself, you know, in 82. The first vintage was 82. It was at some time. It was Domaine de Chastelet. It was a Première Côte de Bordeaux. And at that time, you know, I wanted to have 100% new oak. So I went down to see him. We tasted the 82, which was easy to taste. And I said, you know, how about putting it in 100% new oak? Incredible strike of luck. The guy was an old tonnelier. So we made experiments. We had, you know, 20 different barrels. Different oak, different charring, and so on. So we did. And after that, you know, he accepted me to choose my bottling dates. Because when I tasted the wine, I said, you know, it should be kept. It should be bottled or whatever. And the enologist was not very happy because I always asked for extended stay in the barrel. And, well, I was right. After that, you know, with his own wine, he did what I did.
So I believe your restaurant was quite fashionable and very cool to be in the 80s. Is that correct?
Yes.
Many people came?
Yes.
And that was when your dad was still alive?
Yes.
And your dad was Leon?
Yes.
And he worked for the Citroën car company?
Citroën, yes, exactly. So long days for him because it would start 9:30 at Citroën, leaving at 7 and coming to the restaurant and helping us out, was leaving with us at, 12:30.
What did he think of the restaurant?
He was not interested in the restaurant when it started, but when the restaurant became a little bit better known, he took a serious interest in it.
And so what was that like in the dining room here?
The dining room was packed all the time.
And who were some of the people that you developed a fondness for that would come by?
No, there's not too many celebrities. A lot of celebrities are coming, but I'm not actually friends with them.
Right.
Because most of them are living abroad. And strangely enough, even with artists that I like, I rarely develop an actual friendship. There was one that I was very close to, but I realized it was complicated because sometimes you like their works at an early stage, but after that you don't like it anymore. So it's always difficult to be close to people and say, you know, I'm not buying your work anymore. So.
But you were friendly with Keith Haring, right?
Yes, he came very often. And he brought, you know, George Condo, Kenny Scharf. Because of him, Jean-Michel Basquiat came. But before them, I think it was Schnabel. Schnabel, Salet, Fischel, all these people came.
That was really the 80s power generation for art.
Yes, and they came. And the most faithful was Schnabel.
He took a liking to you and the restaurant?
Yes, he loved the restaurant, and I think one of his wife he met here.
Did you lose a lot of plates because of that? You know, because he does the broken plates on the canvas.
Yes, I do not have a broken plate, which I regret, but I didn't buy one because it's heavy to handle. And at that time, I didn't have the money to buy one. I have two works by Schnabel, but not a plate painting.
When you say to me that it's hard to be friends with someone when you don't like their work, and that can affect your relationship. That, for me, implies that there's like a moral dimension to taste, of aesthetic taste. For you, it's wrong. Is that true, or am I reading too much into it?
Yes, it's more or less true, because I'd rather not say that to people.
Yeah.
So it means that most of the time, I don't want to get too close to people.
I see. You wanted to protect your taste.
Yes. There are people that I like very much. I guess my problem is if I want to be friend with someone, they have to be unfortunately talented and they have to be good human beings.
Yeah. And how did you meet your wife?
It was my cousin's wedding and she was the best girl. And so Christmas 69. She's a Spanish teacher. She only taught for a few years and after that she came to help me. Strangely enough, she didn't study Vietnamese. She studied Japanese, so she has a BA, yes, in Japanese. She also studied after that gemology. She has a diploma.
So like you, many interests, really.
That's true.
I feel like that's been a great way for you to keep life exciting for yourself. Is that a fair statement, to have many interests?
It's strange, but I do, in fact, I have many obsessions. And I spend a lot of time, you know, for wine, food, art, cinema, a little bit literature, but not, and of course, a lot about music.
What are the things or events that have been happy for you?
Many, many.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah. So I taste so many great wines. I ate so many great food. I read fantastic books. I have a very strange stuff about reading, because at the same time I didn't read at all. I was just reading things about wine, food, not fiction. And I went back to fiction because I read a book that I loaned at the I spend my time in libraries. In fact, I'm borrowing a lot of books because I do not want to buy books because it takes too much room.
Exactly.
So I read them first, and when I need them, I buy them. And so it means that sometimes I have to read them twice because I like, you know, underlining, making notes and whatever.
Have there been particular disappointments that have happened in your life?
Disappointment? Not interesting.
Robert Vivian was always finding something new in a glass of wine. Thank you very much for being here today. All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Skella has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website
illdrinktothatpod.com. That's I-L-L, drink to that, P-O-D.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.
Well, Latache is very special, but I'm a bigger fan of the Conti. I still think the Conti is the best of the, almost every year we open the mixed case of the Conti and we taste them blind. The most frequent winner is the Grand Marnier Conti, in spite of the fact that it can sometimes can be lighter, but, it wins often. Latache doesn't win that often. Romanée Saint-Vivant is especially in the young vintage, stunning.